The Known World by Vanitas Hayes, a Stargate Atlantis story featuring McKay Shepard, rated R. At the beginning, he thinks many cliché things, things that make him cringe to think of later. Thoughts such as, I can do this, it's worth it. And it is. Nothing could be worth more than these moments of skin that make his hands shake, bodies as natural as breathing. Of course, of all people, Rodney the asthmatic, the anaphylactic wunderkind, forever being buried or drowned or suffocated or scared, from all this he should remember. Breathing is not always as easy as it appears. Rodney associates sex not with moans or cries, but silence, biting down on his cheek to stuff the noises he makes back into his body, with the sound of clinking dog tags, light counterpart to the heavy bass slap of flesh on flesh. The relationship is a clandestine thing these days, and it's starting to wear on him. The constant worry, the way John won't meet his eyes during a briefing, tosses Mitchell a lemon for God's sake, but kisses him, soft and open-mouthed, just inside his doorway, chessboard tucked under his arm. Oddly enough, he thinks that he could do it if there was no love in the equation, because it may be true that X equals F, when F is fucking and X is the absence of sound, rushing space of nothing noise. It's equal sum. 2 + 2 = 3 + 1. Nothing lost and not much gained. But it is also true that X equals F times B, when F is fucking and X is nothing noise, and B equals sigma P times Y, the sum of Pegasus, horror and wonder and Tela, Ronin, coffee-stained sheets against his cheek, the way his heart stops at the sight of John sun-drenched on an alien world, beautiful like nothing real ever is. All this by itself is an equation he will never be able to balance. Worse, though, is that the much-vaunted N does not exist with the parameters of any known equation, when N is John curled in early morning sheets, hand-fitted to Rodney's hip, except as a negation of itself, N equals negative N, fascinating in its impossibility. The existence of N breaks all the rules, and Rodney thinks he could create a new math around it, given the chance. John, he whispers. Oh, God. Oh, fuck. Right there. Yes. John, love you. Oh. Just give him enough time, he thinks, and he could rewrite the universe. While he's still in nappies, Rodney falls in love for the first time. He cuts his teeth on the leg of the piano bench. He learns dexterity from Chopin, quickens his hands on her keys. He has great technical skill, his instructor says, but no emotion, and he wants to protest that of course he doesn't. He hasn't caught it yet. It. It. Don't you get it? Don't you know? He's 7 years old and chasing after the shape of something he's only heard of. Every note is a footstep, and when he plays, he runs. He writes equations into John's skin, first with touch and the promise of ink, then in the shower with water and soap, off-world with dust. Soon he devolves into sunscreen, antiseptic, lube, anything that might leave a trace. On MX9488, he writes with berry juice after Shepard is passed out from the ceremonial wine, and John wakes up striped with rash and strange swirls and loops. Sum. I. Pi. What the hell, Rodney? He asks, angry. The equations he writes on John's body, they are nothing fancy. F equals MA. E equals MC squared. CD over CI. 2 + 2 = 4. Everything simple that has ever irreparably changed the universe. Anything without which, the universe would be incomplete. The only thing he does not feel the need to write in is blood. There is too much of that between them already. After music, he falls in with science. Night after night, he spends at the telescope, imagining integers in the place of stars. When his teacher tries the old bean and balloon trick to compare the Earth and Sun, he laughs. He's practically iridescent with scorn. He's never had a problem with scale. In this way, he becomes a scientist. No, that's not right. Considering it's the love of his life, science sounds so cruel, so impersonal. Think of it as a lover, or the idea of a lover, the spark that makes matter matter. In it, gravity is a revelation. A spider is a minor miracle. Rodney sticks pins in electrical sockets and didn't talk until he was 4. And years later he reads that his moving hands and stumbling legs and rapid heart are all run by electricity, and very much likes the idea. As a child, Jeannie made up her own language. Unlike the majority child languages, which are soft and malleable, for the most part real words rounded past all recognition, hers was sharp and whistling, difficult. Sometimes she sung to herself in it. It sounded rather like a Bushman click language, and their father was very relieved when Jeannie started speaking English. Rodney, of course, never made up any sort of language. Even as a baby, he wouldn't have deigned to lower himself to that level. With John, though, he seems to have his own ways of communicating. They have 1,000 different semaphore varieties of kisses, simple and soft and hard and hot, and each is a moment too tiny and infinite to be within the parameters of the known universe. "I can't," he says the first time. "I can't." John kisses him, and every breath and every movement says yes, yes, yes. And God, he could tear apart the universe for this man. Destruction for his sake is laughably easy. Harder, though, is not saying fuck it all and letting go, but reining himself in, existing within parameters and rules and the laws that govern both of their lives, both sets so different and yet so achingly the same. "I thought you could do anything, McKay," John says, after. Casual. "Yes, well," Rodney snaps, "even I have my limits." There's a joke going around Atlantis. It's an old one. One of the Daedalus crew members must have thought it up. It goes like this. SG-1 is given a piece of paper with a right triangle on it. The sides are X, 5, and 4, and they are told to find X. Dr. Jackson goes off to inquire about the cultural significance of the ritual. Teal'c looks the questioner in the eye and looms. Carter tries to prove the existence of X through a complex mathematical formula. O'Neill walks up, points at X, and says, "Found it." It's depressing how alike SGA-1 is to SG-1, how few adjustments needed to be made before they could stand in for that joke. Carter once accused Rodney of thinking of people as numbers, but the truth is she was wrong, or at least she was at the time. Then he was young, and people weren't numbers as much as defined by vast sets of mathematical equations that wound around their legs and up through their throats, back when both people and wormholes were unique and beautiful and theoretical and complex. By now, though, he has learned the power of reduction. Now he sees how easily people are not equations, but rather reduced to single integers, dull, interchangeable, only part of a greater sum. If E gets hit by a poisoned spear and goes into convulsions and dies, it is not too hard to slot D in her place. A equals E of D equals D of E equals A. Right? Right. A part of him hates Samantha Carter for making him learn that, for taking him out of the theoretical and into the world never as beautiful as the one in his head. A part of him loves her for it. Another part likes to stare at her breasts. A greater part still sees her stern smile and how much of an asshole he is to her, the way she fucks him over in every universe, and thinks, "Yes, this is it. This is my dream woman." Of course, when Rodney dreams, he dreams of being eaten by a whale, so maybe it's not a fair comparison. Maybe it is not Samantha Carter at all. Maybe this woman dream is not one of flesh or blood, but rules and math, like poetry. This mystery woman, this dream of dreams, the name she gives him is astronomy, but he will later know her as science. It is a 30-year rebound affair that somehow settled into marriage, though he is far happier with his mistress than his father ever was with his. 2 years shy of his 40th, he finds her living in the Pegasus Galaxy, as a place called Atlantis. By his 41st, he decides that all people, excepting him and a small select group, are ignorant pieces of shit that deserve to be thrown on Atlantis's altars, because why else would she burn them, maim them, kill them, send them away? No matter. She's still as timeless as ever. He's getting old. So take a lover, his once lover said. He took a lover. He took John. He writes this for the April 2nd entry in his high school English journal. DS over DT equals the sum of M dot sub K times S hat sub K from K equals 1 to K plus Q dot over T plus S dot sub gen. On May 18th, I cannot wait for this to be over. You small-brained, addled, believing-in-creationism liberal arts bastards, you have no idea how much I cannot wait for this to be over. On June 23rd, just watch me. I am going to change the universe. For the most part, the expedition was easy to peg. Misfits, loners, freaks, and geeks. If you had a reason to stay behind on Earth, you sure as hell didn't come to Pegasus. Even the Atlantis Marines are a little loose, a little crazy. 59% of the expedition population had lost both parents. The anthropologist estimated that over half were at least a Kinsey 3. And Rodney? Well, Rodney is all of those things, and more, hungry for discovery and worried someone else was going to get there first. John, though, John is a mystery. John is insular in a way rarely encountered outside of monasteries. Rodney may not be able to tell the difference between what he wants and what he needs, but John is a study in denial, the excess of little things when forbidden big ones. He will play with motor cars and slouch at attention, but will not fuck without the door double, triple locked. He refuses morphine and rebels against excess emotion. He has not trained himself not to want. He has trained himself to not even think of wanting, to have it pass from his mind. He is entitled to nothing, and so is given everything. For John, Rodney thinks, the world must be very beautiful and very lonely. Idiot, 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 he says between kisses. You are such a fucking idiot. God, I can't believe you survived past birth. Shepard makes a face and opens his mouth. Rodney. Rodney takes half a step back, but his fingers encircle Shepard's wrist, holding loosely. If you say something like, it was only a little scratch, he says softly, I swear to God I will end you. John smiles, oddly, and follows him back into his space. It was only a little scratch, he murmurs, so close Rodney can feel their lips brushing against each other. Breath in a continuous circuit. Right, Rodney says, suddenly weary. His hands smooth over the bandage that hides 28 ugly stitches from view. Right. Here is the way it works. They kiss and touch. John always leaves before Rodney's fully asleep, even though orgasms completely knock him out, and John's lucky if he doesn't walk into a wall on his way back to his rooms. Several times he's been detained by Keller. The first time, she feared some awful Pegasus version of a zombie outbreak. All the times after that, she's assumed insomnia and given him sleeping pills, sent him back to bed. Here is the way it works tonight. They fought this afternoon. As they stumble towards the bed, Rodney attempts to kick off his shoes. It takes a couple tries. There's about a 10-to-1 chance that John will trip on them when he leaves, and so, feeling petty, Rodney positions them for maximum nuisance in the dark. The next morning, Rodney finds John in the infirmary, getting patched up by a sympathetic Keller. I tripped, he says, glaring around his black eye, and Rodney waves cheerfully and grabs more condoms while Keller's distracted. They're running low, and people would actually wonder who Shepard needs them for, whereas in Rodney's case, people think he's just doing it for show, a suspicion which, he admits, at one time may not have been unfounded. By the way, he says, so smug he can taste it, Conan the Barbarian's looking for you. Something about a mid-morning training session? With Marines? If Keller weren't in the way, Rodney suspects John would have jumped up and throttled him, right then and there. As it is, Rodney bounces his eyebrows and escapes unscathed, already plotting breakfast-related schemes. He'll make it up to John later. It's not as if this hasn't happened before. Winter folds into itself, the weird reversal of the calendar throwing everyone from the Northern Hemisphere off balance, including Rodney and John. Post not quite 4th of July, they have drunk, awful sex and nurse hangovers for roughly the next 10 years. Extra Tuesday goes a bit better. There's sex, but of the sweet, slow variety. And how cool is it that John would have been a screamer had he been able to risk making noise? The next time they're Earthside, Rodney promises himself, they'll find somewhere to go where John can scream and grunt and moan to his heart's content. And even as he promises himself this, he knows it won't happen, just because. So many things. Work and relatives, and John and him, and most importantly, this fucked up sort of silent inertial thing between them. He's not even sure if John knows how to fuck anymore without making at least a little of it a punishment. It's a nice dream, though, even if it doesn't feel real. Rodney files it away under fantasy material and gets back to work. "Don't forget," he radios John accidentally on purpose on the public comm, "chess at my place, 1900. "Wouldn't want to miss kicking your ass, McKay," John drawls, and Rodney smiles and wishes he could say, "Oh, please, it's your ass on the line here," an almost innocent joking with the Marines thing, empty except for all that's behind it, but instead just goes, "Dream on, Shepard," and signs off. Rodney's never been taken to writing out his sentiments. Hallmark cards once in a while, maybe a handmade birthday card for his mother, lifetimes ago. Compliments aren't something he gives easily. Instead, he wrote journal articles for his girlfriends, equations for his boyfriends, sent newly published proofs back for his mother's birthdays, and for her funeral. The girlfriends and boyfriends never understood, but he'd like to have thought that his mother did. Her brand of kindness had an edge of the self-serving, too. In Pegasus, every equation he writes is a love letter to John's bruises and sprains and cuts, the things that keep him human, keep him untouched. Rodney thinks about kissing every one each night, in the bed they do not share. This for the smile John gave him today, an instant of realness. This for the bruise John got banging his shins into Rodney's bed frame as he left unsilently in the dark. This for the scrape John got pushing him out of the way. The gun callus on John's thumb, scar at his elbow, hip, neck, divot by his smile. Proof that he... I have to say, output since wedding has gone down, but it is nice to see two people so in love, Zelenka muses. Too rare here. Yes, yes, whatever, Rodney snaps. Throw your rice and get back to work. Love is not disease, Rodney, Zelenka says. You cannot catch it, though I wish you would. Make you nicer, perhaps. If wishes were fishes, the desalination tanks would be full of crap, Rodney retorts. Proof that he says freely, with his body, what he will never say, cannot say, with words. Of course, Einstein is correct, so far, and relativity still stands. The unwashed masses assume it's complex, only useful in deep space and higher mathematics. They are wrong, of course, as they so often are. As Rodney knows, relativity is a relatively simple concept. Put bluntly, things look different from different places, different points of view. A tilt of the head can change the angle of the sun, and every love story is, in a way, an instantaneous parallax, the distance of two poles to a common point. A sees the star as being in a different place than B, but the distance is always the same. No, that doesn't seem right. A and B can strain for the same star and never intersect. His parents are proof enough of this. Think of people as parallel lines, then. Same direction, but never connect. No explosion or combustion or much of anything, really. Infinity as near as it is far. Johnny Cash had it more right than he knew. Human beings are simultaneously solitary and social by nature. Higher brain functions a fair trade for the ability to get in each other's skin. They rose from the muck by hardening their walls, no longer constructing themselves from prokaryote parts of others. America has McDonald's, and China has Mao, and Rodney has science, and no one really connects. When it's not actively saving his life, Rodney looks upon biology as a softer science, nothing like the clean, bright lines of physics. To him, biologists are the monkey nuts who talk pheromones but can't figure out the mechanics of a shower. Last week they lost an alien chicken somewhere near Lab 6 and still haven't managed to recapture it. Put kindly, he has absolutely no patience whatsoever for them unless they figure out a way to make the Wraith all burst into flames, and even then they'd be on probation. It's possible, though, that they may have a point. Perhaps pushing inside John's body, God, so hot, tight, John's heels digging into the small of his back, hairy legs scraping against his sides and raising bruises. Perhaps this is nothing more than a sad imitation of protozoans swallowing oval organelles, spirochetes becoming flagellae, becoming cilia, the migratory bacteria that would become the mitochondria that pump and pulse inside him even now. Perhaps it's wanting what he has, instead of what he doesn't, and it's no less painful. His mother, she compared sex to a closed circuit, but she was wrong. There's nothing electrical about this. It's not even mechanical in the most primal of ways. Nothing about them is closed. A circuit is a conservative thing, and would not allow for an elbow to the side, a break in rhythm, once two radios going off, and an uncoordinated flailing resulting in falling off the bed. Whatever this is, it's biological and shamelessly rude and needy and kind of fun. There's a joke going around Atlantis. It's an old one, but it doesn't matter. They're so strapped for entertainment anyway. This is how it goes. Werner Heisenberg is scheduled to give a lecture at MIT, but he's running late and speeding through Cambridge in his rental car. A cop pulls him over and says, "Do you have any idea how fast you were going?" And then he says, Rodney pauses for maximum effect, waving his beer bottle around rather carelessly. "No, but I know where I am." John snorts, once, and one look between them, that's all it takes, and they're laughing like it's the funniest thing they've ever heard. Rodney's quiet snee snicker to John's loud, awful Muppet laugh. Ha ha ha. They're absolutely horrible sounding, like some sort of concerto for rusty farm equipment, and Ronan rolls his eyes while Taylor smiles in that, for entertainment value, you are slightly more amusing than a trained Bishock kind of way. Okay, wait, I've got one, John gasps out. What's non-orientable and lives in the ocean? What, John? Taylor asks patiently. Mobius Dick, John says slyly, and Rodney comes this close to spewing beer out his nose. Oh, God, that was so awful! Rodney moans when he has his breath back. John smirks and says, Wait, I've got another one. So a neutron goes into a bar and orders a drink. The point of all this, well, in the few precious moments when his mind is not panicked or primal or spinning out an ever-changing theory of the universe that lives inside his head, Rodney thinks about kisses and sex. It seems like the right thing to do. The romantic thing. Maybe he's not the most conscientious boyfriend, but he's caring enough, right? Right. Absolutely. He can care enough for the both of them. Of course, the sex he happily translates from thought to action, every night and occasionally right before lunch. It's the kissing he trips up on. The gentle ones, the absent ones, the ones that featured that particular brand of decay singular to couples in which romance is not even a conscious act but a reflex action, like Taylor whacking him in the ass with a stick. These kisses he leaves in his head, never draws beyond the blueprints of them, and that, too, seems like the right thing to be done. It's what John wants, after all. He's sure of it. And despite what everybody who's ever had any sort of relationship with him before has said, he can be receptive to the needs of others. See, Anna? See, Jeannie? Just watch him. Just watch him go. Summer on Atlantis is hot and humid, like the hotel room in Langley when he was 11, visions of nuclear fallout dancing around his head. It is, to put a cap on it, disgusting. The sea breeze helps, a little, and the metal Atlantis is constructed from doesn't appear to conduct heat very well. Thank God for small favors. But the air is stifling outside, and even indoors, pushed through Atlantis's superb AC system, it's a little thick, a little stale. Ronan calls it Kep weather, and from Taylor's scandalized expression, Rodney concludes that he doesn't even want to know what he means. The Lantians cling stubbornly to their Earth calendar year, even if it's highly impractical, and so Christmas is always celebrated around this time, too, to to put even further damper on things. The only people who seem summer happy are the Australians. Sometimes, though, summer will bring storms, great crashing pantomimes of thunder and salt-heavy rain. They come in late afternoon, early evening, and Atlantis closes the balcony doors of her own accord, seals them with her, in her, gives them the illusion of safety. Even Rodney feels the calm. The hallway's empty, until all that can be heard is a snatch of laughter or music. People present but unseen, a hidden life behind every door. And in theirs, Rodney kisses John slow and lush and full, hands displacing cool air with heat, mapping out bodies as familiar as their own under crumpled white sheets, while rain beats at the window. Sometimes if the storm is long enough, they play chess in bed, arguing softly, not bothering to get dressed. The moments run together. They seem insular and heartbreakingly eternal. They never are. Maybe they're close enough. It's all hot, wet heat, kissing John like nothing of him exists except what's touching. There. Lips and tongue and teeth, hands and mouth and pointy sharp joints that...
Knees!
Rodney squeaks. Watch the knees! Probably the most terrifying part of the whole thing is, he knows Shepard better than anyone, maybe ever, with the exception of Taylor and Ronan. Even then, they don't understand his pop culture references, his TV, silly little things that even the most stupid of Tauri would get. If for nothing else, Rodney is grateful to Batman and Red Dwarf for this, for giving him this chance, a little bit of room to slip through on, because Taylor may know the secret parts of John, the chill and deep darknesses, and Ronan the red places that pulse. But it's only Rodney who knows about the teeth in the shallows, and the bite bruises low on his neck. This is not to say that Rodney understands him. On the contrary, he does not. N still equals negative N. There are some rules he just can't break, no matter how hard he tries. Stay? He asks, uncaring when John flinches.
I can't, Rodney,
John says, equal parts angry and scared, like a cornered animal.
I can't.
Come on, buddy, you know that.
Right,
Rodney mumbles, turning away. Sorry, forgot. There's a joke forming in Rodney's head. It's not very funny, but it's relevant, and a prime example of mathematical humor. It goes like this. According to the rules of the universe, love should not be a matter of A yields B. It should be A in equilibrium with B. Balanced. Whole. It rarely is, but still. Isn't everyone always saying it's a thought that counts? Answer. Yes, that is what everyone is always saying. He might never figure Shepard out in any tangible way. There will be no grand equations, no unifying theories. But he knows him like he knows math. Instinctively. Parts relearned methodically. It's not the grand creativity that Sam and even John exhibit, but it is enough to know that the words and formulas and symbols he's taught, they are only the names worn by concepts that have always lived in his bones. He knows John like he knows the universe, then, knowing there is always more to know. In Pegasus, he faces a new impossibility every lunch hour. Life here for a physicist is like drawing a star chart of his own innards. He's a scientist, though. Everything from the bacteria in his blood to the tilt of a black hole, it's all quantifiable, or at least it should be. John is 1.8288 meters tall, 0.02048 meters taller than Rodney. He is 80 kilograms, or to be more precise, 81.82 kilograms. Rodney is a fine full figure of a man who doesn't need to get into discussions of weight. John's lips are roughly one thumb span, or at least that's what seems to fit there, just brushing or sunk into the heat, teeth nipping the pad. One of his eyes is 0.834 centimeters above the other. There are 6 freckles on his left forearm, 2 on his right, and scattered across his body, John carries 27 scars of varying sizes. Sadly, none of these seem to make a difference one way or another. John divided by John equals John. He can't seem to reduce it any further than that. The end.